Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. Today in the studio, we have Luke, who is in person.
Wow. Hi, guys.
And we have Fiona, who is also in person. And we have in person our guest, Steph Clark. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Steph and I know each other in paths that have crossed through Pilates and airport lounges. And then social media, we kind of see what each other are up to. And I was like, you're doing some cool things. And so we have invited Steph to tell us about things that have been happening. But maybe firstly, Steph, tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Oh, so a little bit about myself. So I'm Steph. I'm a POM. I've been here in Australia for nearly 11 years. I am a futurist, a facilitator, and a friendship enthusiast. Currently writing a book about friendship, which I think we will get into as we talk this morning on this podcast. And I am, I do a lot of Pilates, a lot of hiking, generally found outside, ruining my body in some way, shape, or form. Currently nursing a rotator cuff injury
as a result. Oh, no.
It's normally a case of like, what has Steph injured recently?
Oh, wow.
So, shoulders currently, yeah. Ouch. Someone said it's wear and tear, and I was like, please, it's too much fun. less of this wear and tear nonsense, more of like, you've been living too well.
Yeah, yeah. Positive spin.
Yeah, nice reframe.
Thanks.
Well, Steph, the first question that we might collectively ask you, and this is the question we ask everyone as soon as they're introduced to us, is what generation are you? And I guess when you think about that generation, what do you think is the trait of that generation that defines you the most?
Other than, millennial and being, other than being obviously very cringe.
I didn't say it.
No, I mean, I was sitting in your eyes though. Like, the thing that my most millennial trait maybe is probably that my karaoke song would be Mr. Brightside by The Killers. Told you it was cringe.
That song is actually making a comeback in Gen Z circles.
Is it really?
Yeah. Good to know. I think it's a song that I'm seeing a lot more like at when you like go out and like are at bars and stuff, people will stop conversations to be like, oh, I love this song.
Yeah. It's because the indie sleaze thing is like having a big moment again as well.
So yeah.
This is, and it's part really kind of within that, I guess.
100%.
So I also do like that song, but I haven't listened to it in a while actually, so I might have a listen on the way home. But you said you're a POM and that you've been here for 11 years. Tell us how you came to Australia and why Australia.
Obviously, being British, I want to be like, well, on a plane. The sarcasm never leaves you. Why did I come to Australia? The easiest answer is for the weather, because it was February 2014. I was working in London at the time, and I mean, anywhere in the UK in a February is pretty awful. If you've spent much time in the UK, you will know that. This particular February was particularly awful, very cold, very rainy, very windy. We'd had all these big storms, and I was in the kitchen in the office, and there was a guy called Chris who just got back. He'd been in Sydney for 8 years working for EY, which is where I was in at that time. And I was like, Chris, they're still looking for anyone to kind of backfill your role. And he was like, oh, I think they might be actually. So I went back to my desk and I had a look on the internal jobs website, and they were basically advertising my role, which was very similar to the role that he was doing, anywhere down, pick your office down the east coast of Australia. And I was like, oh, well, this is good. So I applied, or I text my then partner and was like, hey, do you want to move to Melbourne? And he was like, yep, cool, sounds good. So I got home, I sat at my desk and applied for this job, got home that night, and he was like, oh, what was that thing about that Melbourne thing? And I was like, oh yeah, I've applied for a job. He was like, cool, let me know if we need to move to the other side of the world. So we did, and yeah, I got the job and moved that July, so July 2014. So last year was my 10-year Ozziversary. And yeah, just kind of really enjoyed living here ever since. My role when I moved here took me all around Australia and into a lot of kind of the Asia Pac region as well. So I spent a lot of time on planes, but also around Australia. So whilst I've been in Melbourne for a long time, it feels like I've kind of been all over Australia and kind of seen quite a lot of it. And often Australians are like, oh, you've seen more of Australia than I have.
So, probably true.
Yeah. Which is, I think, is always the case when you're not from a place. So So I've been here since then, and got my citizenship, and because I've got my double passports and all the rest. Hopefully those still mean something, depending on what happens with elections and things over the next few months. But I wouldn't rule out living somewhere else. I've never sort of say never to anything, but yeah, at the moment, this is definitely where I like being based.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask, with Australia, because one thing I've noticed now from traveling, you know, to different places is that Australia is very far away from everything.
Correct.
How did it feel kind of acclimating to that? Because even though I know that the UK is not necessarily connected to the rest of Europe, you're right next to everything. How did it go from being like, oh, I can trip and I'll fall into another country to like being on your own isolated island?
I guess at first, because there's such novelty of being here, you almost don't notice that. And because you're then relatively closer to Southeast Asia, you know, some of Indonesia, kind of other areas as well, New Zealand, of course, which I'm a huge fan of. And so you almost, you know, I certainly found that I was more excited by that and the proximity to new things and different things that were very different, because Europe's great. And I love Europe and going to Europe very much. And I always try and do a side project when I go back to the UK. However, they're all kind of pretty similar. They all kind of look pretty similar. You've got to go quite far to actually get something quite different. Mm. Whereas from Australia, yes, you might have to get on a plane for 8 hours. But when you do get somewhere else, you're like, oh, this is really quite different.
Yeah.
So I think that for me is more interesting. And I guess the type of travel I like to do is probably more aligned to the stuff that is on this side of the world as well, certainly at the moment.
What's your favourite country to have visited?
Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a basic answer, isn't it? But I just love it.
I feel that. Yeah. When I started this podcast, I was here for like a month. And then after that, I did a month just traveling around Japan.
Yeah. Amazing.
Why do you like Japan?
I mean, the food's obviously incredible. can't go past that. It's just a very different type of history, a very different kind of culture. And I'm really into stationery. So as you can sort of nerd out, it's a sort of place you can just nerd out on stuff. And I just think it's really cool. And I think it's really interesting there, you know, going from kind of technology leaders in the last few decades into something that's maybe less... there's definitely less at the forefront now of some of that. And I think that's really interesting as well from a kind of cultural perspective. So yeah, somewhere I'd really like to spend a bit more time and really understand a little bit more as well.
I think stationery is also quite a millennial trend. a real interest in stationery. Not that I was calling you out there, but
No, thank you. Yeah. You've got a little like checklist of cringe going
on. Yeah, well, we're only at two at the moment, so that's fine.
So in your introduction and also in your LinkedIn bio, you refer to yourself as a futurist, a facilitator, and a friendship enthusiast. And I'm just wondering for our listeners, if you can unpack what you mean by that.
By all of them?
Yeah.
Shouldn't start. So futurist. Okay, let's start with the futurist one. So futurist is the role I play in a lot of the work I do. So in short, it's working with organizations, generally exec teams, leadership teams, to think more broadly around what might happen next in their environment, in the political landscape, in technology, in the world, in whatever kind of field, and think about what the impact might be on their organization and them as well personally, or in their role that they're playing, and whether they and their organization will stay relevant and be sustainable in that particular future. Now, that's particularly interesting work, as you can probably imagine, and involves everything from writing scenarios around some possible futures that may play out and stress testing that organization's current business models or strategies against those particular scenarios, but also through to things like creating artifacts from a future, or like things that might exist in a particular future. And again, using those to provoke a conversation. So with a good example is a homewares retailer I did some work with about 18 months ago, created the catalogs that they might send to their customers in 2030, the types of products they might be selling, the kind of partnerships they might have, the types of social norms that might exist or policies that might exist, all kind of embedded in this thing that might exist. So rather than just being like, this policy might exist, it's kind of like within the images, the language, the product sets that they had. And then taking that to the exec team, setting them off to kind of review these catalogs that I had printed and all glossy and everything. And then having the conversation where they were like, half of the group was sort of like, oh, this went too far. And half the group were like, no, this didn't go far enough.
Ah.
And like, cool, this is the conversation. Like, the stuff I create is fun and great and it provokes the conversation, but it's really a vehicle to the conversation, which is where the facilitation part comes in. And I think the biggest impact I can have and often do have in the work I do is by facilitating the future And so facilitating those conversations, facilitating the testing of assumptions, facilitating the process of actually slowing down to think about what might happen next, which might then provoke a different conversation and sometimes a more existential and sometimes a much harder conversation around what even are we as an organization, and is what we have always done really going to be the thing that allows us to continue as an organization into the next decade, let's say.
And there was one word you used that I have just like stuck to me, which is relevancy. And when we're talking about a future, you know, not only all future is uncertain, but on top of that, we live in a time where everything is fast paced, things change really quickly. How do you facilitate reflection and development of like relevancy strategies, I guess?
A big part is that testing of assumptions. So what are we assuming about the future? What are we assuming about what may or may not be still true or still relevant, you know, as well in, you know, 5 years, 10 years, whatever kind of time frame we're playing with for that particular project or client piece of work. So the relevance question then comes down to, well, what are we assuming to be true? And therefore, how does that then stack up around what we are now doing? And there's obviously a lot of assumptions you have to then make with that. And there's also, the point is not around prediction. I think that's probably one of the biggest parts of the work is getting people away, and especially people in quite technical fields, which most people are that I work with, who are very used to being right and very used to only what is right being right.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking about actually there's a bunch of possibilities. As you say, it's like really uncertain. No one knows what the future is. If they say they do, they're probably trying to take your money. So this is very much around possibility, not prediction. And therefore trying to use that to navigate any particular future that may play out, because if you can imagine it, you can then plan for it and be a bit more prepared. And it's, again, it's about kind of preparedness, not around being a prepper, which is very different connotations.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Preparedness and not being a prepper. Explain that a bit more.
So for me, the difference is around preparedness is around, again, thinking broadly around the possibilities, what might play out, what is possible. And then thinking about, in these types of situations, we would do these things.
Yeah.
And potentially then also having some backup plans kind of stored away or whatever. But probably more importantly, knowing what to look out for.
Yeah.
And I think this is the bit that's often missing in organizations, is everyone's so busy doing today's work and fighting today's fires. No, very few people are kind of looking up, looking ahead and being like, oh, that's a much bigger problem
than yeah.
that way. Until it is on you and you are on fire.
Yeah.
That's bad. And so therefore, we need to sort of spend that time looking up, but also seeing those things coming first. So by focusing on preparedness, we can then also know what to look out for.
Yeah.
And start to see and start to agree as a leadership team or as an exec team or as a board, okay, we know that when we see these things starting to happen or hear these things starting to happen, we might need to go and dig up that plan B or C or D that we came up with when we thought about that possible future playing out. Even if it's not playing out in exactly the same way, there'll be some level of overlap. Versus being a prepper, which is about more around thinking about those things, but then reacting to all of them.
Yeah.
Which is more around the stockpiling the toilet roll and, you know, those kinds of maybe slightly less helpful, though the way the world is going, maybe not completely ridiculously unnecessary. So I think that's, for me, is the difference, is more around the kind of thoughts and having some kind of strategy around that versus just reacting to every possibility.
That's a really great distinction. And I guess, like, you know, I think about it even in my work as an academic, sometimes we can get too caught up in just being the scientist and the work that we do on the day to day. And I often have conversations with my team that, no, look up, read broadly, listen to what's happening in the world. Like, yes, we still have to do the research. Yes, we still have to do the science, but there's a bigger world out there that's going to actually impact what we are doing potentially going into the future. And we're seeing that play out in all different ways. So. Yeah.
And I think that's so important in academia and in sort of the sciences more broadly, because a lot of the problems are becoming just so much more complex and therefore so much more interdisciplinary.
Yes.
And therefore, if we can look at things across and be able to kind of see adjacent, and actually just even being able to see adjacent problems and see how those are being solved or approached, or, you know, even if they're not being solved, then that's useful.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't immediately solve your problem. But being able to think about things in different ways and see those connections is so, so vital.
So cool. And then you're a friendship enthusiast.
Yeah, and the friendship enthusiast is, something I've kind of added for fun into my kind of bio because it like links to the book that I'm writing, but it also is true of my life. And so it is something that I have for a long time really focused on in my life is my friendships and the quality of those and the and trying to be a good friend, etc. But more recently, kind of turning that into a bit more of towards the work I do. So some of the stuff I do is around the future of friendship, because where I blend the kind of future stuff with the friendship stuff. But then also the book I'm writing, which is around helping people come up with different ways or inspire people to think about different ways of deepening and doing more interesting things with their friendships in more meaningful ways, rather than making new friends. So the book is less about making new friends and much more around deepening your existing friendships and connections.
Just with being a futurist, what channels are you watching or reading or keeping up to date with to do that? Like, are you on a lot of social media? Are you reading a lot of newspapers? Are you reading a lot of books? What, where are you getting your stuff from?
A bit of everywhere.
Okay.
And I personally think the broader and more weird your sources are, probably the more interesting futures you're going to think of as well. So it's everything from, like you say, social media. I wouldn't describe myself as an extremely online person, but I'm pretty online. I don't use all the networks, but anyway. But things like Discord channels are really great. So some of the Discord channels I'm on, you just get all sorts of input from all sorts of different places that stuff I just would never come across as well. From, again, really weird, wonderful, niche publications or social media things, whatever. So definitely kind of Discord channels, super useful. Mainstream media, obviously, can be useful to a point as well. Generally, by the time something's in the mainstream media, it's kind of not really a signal it's probably happening.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a sort of signal of something maybe happening. Although, again, there is still relevance in more mainstream stories, obviously, as well. Because it actually shows that something has changed or is changing. So even though it's not a weak signal, maybe. Anyway, so mainstream media, podcasts, definitely a big input for me. Substack as well, following some Substacks and things. Try and get a mix between people who are curating stuff. So they've kind of done some of that filtering for me on, so someone like Casey Lewis's Substack, which is called After School, which is around Gen Z, Gen Z kind of experience as well. So she does a lot of that filtering of content. So that's really useful. But then also getting people who are doing more kind of original writing around a topic as well, because I guess that just brings a different view. And then the other thing is sci-fi. Like, I try and my sort of professional development for myself over the last couple of years has been to read and watch more sci-fi. And that's more from the imagination perspective, sort of broadening, like, oh, actually, yeah, that could play out. And not to just mimic those storylines in the scenarios I'm writing, but just to take those little kind of, those little nuggets of consequence and story to be like, oh, okay. And what if this? Or now, the other week I watched Blade Runner for the first time. I know, I'm terrible. Like, I've only just watched that. But
I haven't watched it.
I'm a terrible futurist. Anyway, watched that for the first time. And that was really interesting because it's about trying to find these robot humans who are kind of infiltrating the human world and who have come off their planet, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I was like, oh, okay. Now, in the context of 2025, this feels very different. And so now it made me think about like other ways that could play out in a 2025 future rather than a 1982, whenever that kind of came out.
And you bring, like, I know people can't see you, but you bring an incredible amount of energy to a room. Like, I'm sure you're aware of it. And so when you're going into these big businesses, how does that go? Because I can imagine you're talking to a board or something like that and they're all like, whoa, you know what I mean? Like, it would be incredible for them. How do you go with that?
Just wowing everyone.
Literally.
I'll pay you later.
Yeah.
Fiona's now in charge of my PR and marketing. I think part of it is that is kind of what I'm selling in some ways as well, is that kind of injection of like, well, have you thought about these things? Again, like with some groups, I have to moderate that a little bit more. Or the interesting thing is more selling the relevance of that, because everyone loves the kind of conversation of like, look at all this weird stuff happening. Everyone's like, oh my God, look at the weird stuff. That's great in like a keynote or something where you're doing a bit more awareness kind of stuff. Cool. But when you're actually working with a board or an exec team, the thing that people really value is that injection of interesting insight and that injection of energy or of curiosity or of whatever. And I think there's still some stuff that plays in my favor. The fact I used to be an accountant and I was an accountant for a number of years. I think some people, rightly or wrongly, are still like, oh, okay, you are a proper person then. Like, Anyway, that's a conversation for another time, but there is that kind of
legitimacy.
Legitimacy. That kind of gives me as well, even though it's not the career I have anymore. I've been clean for over a decade on my accounting. So therefore, and I'd be very dangerous as an accountant now, but there is that kind of that legitimacy, like you say, Dash, that gives, like, okay, you have worked in big organizations, you have worked in a field that they recognize, because that's what, you know, a lot of them have a finance background as well, especially working with boards and exec teams. So yeah, so I think that's it's trying to balance all of those things. Mm-hmm. And the fact that at the moment, especially in Australia, the market and the maturity around future thinking, strategic foresight is not very mature. Mm. And so the ones who, the kind of what I'd say the early adopters, the ones who are getting it, the ones who are showing that kind of curiosity at the moment, are the ones who are probably more aligned, because they have also got that energy, they've also got that curiosity, they've also got that openness to have a really existential big conversation that might question everything that their organization is doing. Mm. And so at the moment, there's probably more of a match with that. There's probably still some people who, you know, within those boards or groups or, you know, execs who are like, I don't know about this, and definitely have seen that. But I think then when you've got some sponsors who are like, yeah, this is what we need, you can kind of run with that. And that's what they want. That's what they're kind of buying. Mm.
Mm. When you kind of go up with, you know, go up against some of that reluctance, what would you say is kind of the key fact or thought underpinning that? Do you think it's just general kind of fear of change and like uncertainty?
I think it is a bit of uncertainty. I think there is a piece of just an unfamiliarity with the field of futures thinking, strategic foresight, like what can this bring? People just aren't used to kind of buying it.
Yeah.
Like they know when they buy a facilitator come run their offsite, they know, okay, well, I'm going to get someone, they're going to come and run some activities, we're going to do some stuff, like, cool. They know when they buy someone to come do their strategy work, they kind of know what the outcome of that's going to be. This kind of sits somewhere between all of those things and can be any or none of those, but it's just less familiar, and therefore they need a bit more on the value, kind of that ROI kind of piece. And I feel like probably here there is probably a little bit more emphasis on, well, what's the ROI, rather than let's try it. It's probably a little bit less like that, especially when it's new for them. So I think there is an element of that. And I think there is just the piece of, yeah, the uncertainty. And like, well, are we going to get the answer? And this idea of right, I think that's that's the other part that can undo people a little bit as well. Like, well, you don't know what that is. Like, no, I don't know what that is. And that's not what I'm promising.
Yeah.
But what we're going to do is we're going to explore what could or what might. Yeah. And then so what, which is the important bit.
So it's almost like working towards like a future is really about having that open-mindedness to explore what that might look like. But if you come in and maybe explain that to some people, they may be like, well, okay, but what are we doing? What are we preparing for? It's like, well, everything, I guess.
Everything and nothing and somewhere in between those things. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other piece is, and I think it's the everything, it's the nothing, but also the exploration together and thinking about what might, and then for that to be a really co-created conversation. But most importantly, that actually a lot of that future we do have agency on as an organization, and we might not be able to control all the elements of what happens, particularly on the external. However, we can respond and we can have agency over what we do about that, rather than waiting for it to happen to us. Like, and whether that's a policy thing that we can maybe influence or lobby, depending on the, you know, the industry or whatever, or it is a piece of technology that we can be really thoughtful about how we integrate that so that it doesn't have the potentially just really, you know, hugely disruptive impact that it could do, but actually really thinking about what it is, what can we control and what can we influence and what do we need to adapt to.
Yeah, so it's really a development of these, really, as you mentioned before, it sounds like somewhat underdeveloped thinking skills, as opposed to writing out anything that needs to be set in stone. And I imagine that would be really hard to sell to certain people, where it's like you will come to a point where you'll realize how useful this is, just maybe not right now.
100%. Yeah, and last year there was a project I worked on with that, but that was very much the case. There was, on the most part, everyone in the group was fully on board and they got it, and yeah, not that they found it easy, some of them found it really challenging, but there was definitely a couple of people who were like, but what's the answer then? Like at every workshop, even though we kept kind of going like, okay, the point of this session is to explore, the point of this session is to look at what's happening, blah, blah, blah. Right, okay, but what are we going to do about it? Oh, well, that's what we're going to do in like a month, maybe. But so actually sometimes the skill is being able to hold to the process a little bit. And actually the feedback I got by the time we finished that project was, oh, I'm really glad you did keep us to the process,
yeah,
rather
yeah
than letting us force you or force it to an answer, because that's what we have been conditioned to in, you know, particularly in big organizations and things, like every meeting has to have an outcome. And again, we don't want to be just, you know, never doing anything. Of course, there is a line. But for most people, and particularly more senior people, it's not very comfortable to spend time doing deep thinking and to just spend, you know, several sessions and workshops doing that sense making, doing that exploration. I think your point on those undervalued deep thinking skills is absolutely spot on. Like, that is exactly, which is a very hard thing to sell to someone.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. By the way, you're not very good at thinking deeply, and that's not the case. Like, for most people, that's not the case. But it's more the prioritization of it.
Yeah.
So actually, this gives people and forces them to have a broader conversation, a deeper conversation, and probably certainly the feedback I get is a more interesting conversation as well.
And I thought I just kind of had, sorry, I'm kind of taking over I'm just fascinated by it. It's really interesting because right now we're coming from the lens of, well, maybe we're talking about organizations that, and obviously I'm speaking quite bluntly here, like, you know, maybe they're out of touch or they haven't thought about these things. But what I'm thinking about as well, and how valuable this would be, is for actually people going into kind of influencer related careers where, you know, they hit it big time, they have one viral thing, they try and build an entire brand off of it, and they try and coast for as long as possible.
Hawk tour, are we?
I wasn't talking about anyone specifically, but that's a great example of where we're at now, where it's like within a month you can have a multi-million-dollar commodity there that you're selling, and then within another month it's completely gone, the value is completely depreciated. Mm-hmm. So I could imagine how valuable this would be for people in that situation where all of a sudden they've got management teams and they've got people just trying to make as much money as they can from this, and to have someone go, hold on, longevity, sustainability, what are we actually trying to do here? I could imagine that would be super valuable as well.
Yeah, and there's a interesting stat from so PwC every year do a CEO survey. And in 2024, the CEO survey said that 85% of Australian CEOs felt that even if they changed nothing about how they're running their business and their organization, they would still have a relevant business in 10 years' time.
Wow.
85%. Globally, that was 55%. So it was a 30% difference in the kind of optimism of, and even PwC in a kind of probably more polite way were like, we think Australian CEOs might be being slightly over-optimistic on this. And it makes me think, well, actually, there's a bunch of things potentially happening there. It is a complete lack of understanding of what's actually happening, mm-hmm, you know, if I'm being really, really blunt.
Mm-hmm.
There is a reality that they are so busy on today, they just haven't looked up to be like, oh, God, have you seen that? Like, that's going to be even bigger problem. Or there is just the Australian, she'll be right.
Mentality.
The mentality there, like, we've, you know, the lucky country, we've managed to avoid all the other bad things, we'll be fine. Again, and there's probably some of those, all of those, none of those, you know, in different situations. Now, interestingly, in the 12 months between the 2024 CEO survey and the 2025 one, that confidence level of Australian CEOs dropped by 10%. So this year it's 75% of Australian CEOs.
Okay, interesting.
And I think that for me, and again, sample size of whatever, so, you know, the scientists in the room will be upset about this, but the conversations I've had with more people in that 12-month period is, to me, slightly indicative that that is shifting, because more people are like, hey, can we have a conversation about this futures thing?
Yeah.
Because we're not, you know, feeling kind of a bit uncertain, like things are like, what about this AI thing? Like, it feels like this year there's been, just as in 2025, in the last sort of 3 months, feels like there's been a bit more of an awakening on AI by a lot of not the biggest organizations, they feel like they're a bit more across it, but they're kind of medium kind of organizations, and some of the smaller ones, like, oh, this AI thing might be a thing, like, yeah, welcome to the party.
Yeah.
Welcome to the weird side. And so again, like, you know, with things like that, when you've got a big thing like an AI thing, and obviously what's happening in certain other countries as well, there is potentially just a more awareness of, oh, this could really impact us, oh, we should think just more broadly about what we're doing. Yeah.
I'm very curious listening to you talk, Steph, that you were an accountant for a very long time and then transitioned.
Too long, some
transitioned into starting your own business and doing this. And, you know, millennials are the generation that, you know, started the whole we won't stay in the same job for a very long time. How did you come to the decision to leave accounting, set up your own business and start doing this full time?
So the decision to leave accounting probably started probably like 2 weeks after I started accounting. it was a quick turnaround. I was sat doing my kind of audit 101 training in kind of week two or whatever of joining. And so I joined EY when I was 18. So in the UK, they have this amazing school leavers program. I'm still such a huge fan of the apprenticeship model, the school leaver model. It just gives so many more opportunities and options to people who either don't want to go to university, like I didn't, or don't have the means to, especially with the price of that, you know, just being prohibitive for a lot of people. So in the UK, there's a big, and now even more so than 20 years ago, there is a huge industry around apprenticeships and things. So amazing, big fan. So I joined when I was 18, and sort of 2-3 weeks in, we were in the our training of audit 101, and I sort of sit there thinking, oh, I don't know if this job's really going to be for me, but what that guy's doing at the front of the room and teaching us, that looks way more fun. So I basically spent the next 3 years qualifying to be an accountant, doing my audit, you know, being an auditor and doing audits and things, hating life mostly, loving the people I was working with, that was the only thing that kept me there, and running all these little training sessions so that then by the time I qualified, the learning team, the central learning team that existed, that I knew existed, would have no excuse but to say I could join them. This was my like grand plan,
yeah.
19 or whatever, 18, 19. So I just did all this stuff to try and like make myself completely appealing to the learning team, and then moved into learning. When I had qualified, they let me in, and I just basically never left. And still did a bit of audit for a couple of years, kind of a bit of an overlap, sort of dual role. But yeah, so I think it was about 7.5 years in that I stopped doing any audit and just did the learning role, and loved that. Like it was so fun. And that's what I did when I moved to Australia as well. So it's just sort of around that time had made that full transition. And yeah, and then sort of after 13.5 years in total there, I left in March 2019, so just 6 years ago this month.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd started my business probably 18 months before that, but just really kind of just posting stuff on LinkedIn, just really kind of building, like deciding what I wanted to do. That was less in the future space, more in the kind of learning and facilitation leadership kind of world, which is what I was doing more at EY. And then the futures thing has been sort of the last sort of 3 years or so. Anyway, so the thing that really was the catalyst for me wanting to leave and then start my own thing was a couple of things. Number one, I really miss being client facing. Like I bloody hated audit, but I really loved the dynamic of like working with clients. Really loved getting in and being professionally nosy, like
yeah.
Understanding everything about their business, which is funny because the thing I was always told off about as a child was like hiding behind doors and like listening to other people's conversations. Should have definitely been like a spy or something, but I'm very heavy on my feet. I've been a terrible spy. And so yeah, being professionally nosy, like understanding a client's business, like winning around the clients who are like, oh, the auditors are in again, and just like charming them. Like I just loved all of that kind of stuff, like that dynamic. And that just external facing piece. So I really missed that when I had the learning role. So it was that. And I kind of just looked around and I'd done, you know, I'd been really lucky. I'd kind of created all these roles for myself, like moved careers, had, you know, moved countries. I'd worked, done projects in 12 different countries by the time I left. And so I was just like, kind of, I'm out, I'm done. I've completed EY.
Yeah.
Completed professional services. And no, I sort of looked around at other roles and thought, oh, you know, are any of those appealing? And what would I create myself? I was always pretty good at just creating myself a position or a role. And I just thought, oh no, I think the position I'd want to create is the one I could create on the outside. Like, why would I not do that there and have that external facing part as well? So yeah, so 2017 was probably sort of late 2017 is when I started to think that. And I thought, right, what's the kind of runway for me to do that in terms of, you know, financially kind of having a bit of a buffer, but also how do I kind of build a brand, you know, so that I can, when I leave, have a pipeline of work rather than leaving being like, all right, anyone want stuff? That I felt was probably not going to be very successful.
Yeah. And is it what you expected it to be?
In a lot of ways, yeah, because I knew it was going to be fun and creative and give me this grounding to just kind of do what I wanted in lots of ways in terms of the type of work I wanted to do with the type of people I want to work with, both clients and people I've collaborated with and been really lucky enough to work with. And that it would shift and change. Like the business I have now is nowhere close to the business I had when I started. And that one really makes me cringe. And it should, because your early work should make you cringe.
Yeah.
And not just because I'm a millennial. This doesn't go on the checklist. And this version will make me cringe in 5 years or 3 years or maybe in a year. And I'm really excited about that because I think that's a sign of progress and development and self-awareness maybe around your cringe level.
But yeah.
Yeah.
And growth. Like it's like, if you stay the same and never cringe at yourself, that's probably not a good sign. But I'm just curious. I mean, I think it can look very glamorous or it can look very fun. I saw a post you did recently where you were all having breakfast together and I was like, oh, so fun. But what might be the darker side or the more challenging side of working for yourself and doing all of that?
I think it's different for everyone. Like I've never found, I'm a card-carrying extrovert, and the thing that has never been a problem for me is the loneliness of running your own thing. Like, yeah. I've always had other people around. Like there's always people I can collaborate with. I've got some amazing friends that I've made through us doing our own thing and kind of just becoming friends. So that's bit, there's never been a problem. But I know, you know, when I left, I was like, oh, maybe that will be an issue because, you know, I liked having a team and working around people and stuff. Anyway, so that's less of the issue, which was maybe a surprise. The probably the two things. Number one is like the first year or so at sort of 9 a.m. you're like, oh, gotta do the thing. And then you're like, oh no, I don't have to do the thing because I'm in charge. So there's that. And sort of deconditioning yourself to the kind of 9 to 5 piece and just working when makes sense and, you know, being flexible with that. So there's that piece. The thing I actually found, so that was just the process, but the thing I found more difficult was I was always pretty motivated and fairly good at climbing the ladder and kind of doing the thing to get the next thing or the next role or the next project. There's always a carrot.
Yeah.
And then when you realize you're the carrot farmer, you're like, oh, but I didn't plant any carrots. There are no carrots.
Yeah.
What's the thing that's going to motivate me to keep going? And not that, and yeah, not that I'm completely motivated by like a promotion or a title or whatever. More, it was always more around like the next opportunity rather than like the title per se. It was more around the role or whatever. But realizing that you have to kind of rethink what that looks like and means as well, because there is no next role. There is just a fun project or a different thing. So it's more around thinking, okay, well, how do I think about the projects or the type of work I'm doing or the output as the next carrot rather yeah. than the role or the kind of the thing that someone else has given me? So it's more, it has to be a slightly more internally created, I guess, in some ways. So there's that. And then the last one is probably one that's been a bit more relevant more recently, which is just when things are slow and just being like, oh, well, how do I spend my time? Because you end up, and you know, I definitely find myself ending up in these weeks where I've kind of got not enough work on to kind of spread over 5 days. So I don't necessarily, you know, work the 5 days, whatever, because, you know, rethink that. But then you end up doing like a little bit of that every day, but then a little bit of nothing every day, and then never really feeling like the day is particularly good in a leisure way or a work way.
Yeah.
So then that's the bit I probably find hardest, and especially when you're like, oh, what should I be doing more of to kind of stop that being the case?
Yeah.
So I think there's that's probably the harder bit, is that kind of relationship with the work, the leisure piece, and the sort of the quiet time, because that's also one of the benefits of this type of setup is that when it's quiet, you can kind of, you know, provided you can meet your needs and all the rest from a financial perspective, you have free time, which is great. But only if you can use that free time well.
Is that free time, do you see that as writing your book or is that work?
I mean, I should. I feel very attacked now, Fiona. Like, why are you using that free time to write the damn book? Well, I don't know, Fiona. Why aren't I using my free time to write the book? I don't really see any of it as work.
Yeah.
Like, it's stuff I do.
Yes.
And I think I have quite a loose relationship with the idea of work now in this setup. And not in a, like, hippie kind of, like, I've transcended work. Like, that's that's ridiculous. But more in that kind of like, it's all just stuff I do and it's fun and it's interesting. Like there's some bits that are annoying, sure, like, you know, some admin. But, like, it's, yeah, I don't really think of the book as work, and I don't often think a lot of my work about my work as work as well.
Yeah.
But not in the, and yeah, actually, maybe this is just my own thing, but not that it's not important or kind of serious.
Yeah.
But then work doesn't always have to be.
Because I'm looking at Steph and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to look up a lot more, and I want my life to be like that. I'm feeling very inspired.
Oh, thanks. I'll probably look into some of my voice notes with my friends, but might make you think otherwise.
So coming into the friendship,
yeah,
what's happening with that? Like, how did that evolve? I'm really interested in that.
In terms of actually just approaching the topic.
And, yeah.
So it's definitely something that's always been important to me, and but it's never really been like a thing. It's just like a thing I do. And a thing that my friends kind of know me for as well. Like the last few years, for my birthday, I've had Steph Estival, because... and it's been a series of different events with different friends, and you know, each of them has like a theme. Anyway, it's been super fun. But a couple of years ago, as part of Steph Festival, there was a dinner I had with some friends. It's five friends and me around my dinner table, because I love cooking for people and hosting. And I invited them all, and none of them knew each other. So it was all friends I knew from different parts of my life. Some of them knew of each other and, you know, blah, 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 but no one knew each other. Anyway, so beforehand, I sent all of them a message with like a little one-line intro to each person, but nothing about their work. It was all about like them, their hobbies, their, you know, whatever it was, super something just fun. Ask them about kind of thing, or, you know, something that type of thing. So my friend Emily, it was like, ask her about the fact she has just hiked the length of New Zealand. Ask her, you know, my friend Viren, it was like, ask him about his DJing, yeah, whatever it was. And what was really cool by the end of the evening, and a couple of people kind of noticed afterwards, or sent me a message the next day, were like, oh, we didn't talk about work at all for anyone. Even though, like, normally when you get together with a group of people you don't know, like, at some point, probably fairly quickly, oh, what do you do, is going to kind of come up. The only way it came up was, like, very quickly as part of, like, a kind of joke about my friend Mike, who's a psychologist. And so there was, like, a joke about, oh, and this is why he's a psychologist, yeah, kind of thing. Like, that was kind of as close as we got to talking about anyone's work. And it was just so great, because we just had, like, a really expansive, interesting conversation about just stuff, and it was super fun, very funny. Anyway, so I'm kind of known for in my friend groups for like doing stuff like that, and kind of being the one who initiates the kind of the get-togethers or the things that are kind of interesting and fun, and just being very organised. And so last year, last kind of October, I think it's September, October, a friend of mine forwarded me a newsletter from someone who, and in this newsletter, this person was like, oh, you know, we should celebrate our big birthdays. I think she'd just been to her 50th or a 60th or something. And, you know, we should make sure we celebrate our big birthdays, because, you know, we don't know if we're going to get them and it's not guaranteed and blah, blah, blah. All very, very good. But I was enraged by this, because I was just like, no, we shouldn't just celebrate our birthdays. We shouldn't just celebrate our big birthdays. We should celebrate all our birthdays. But also, make up shit to celebrate. Like, it doesn't have to be just a birthday. Like, why are we not celebrating more than birthdays? Why are we not celebrating? Like, I saw a reel on Instagram. Sorry. So very cringe. Tick that one off. About someone who threw a party for getting like a 300-day streak on Duolingo. Like, and they had a cake with the owl, and they had a whole thing. Like, it was super fun. I was like, this is the stuff. Like, we should just make up excuses to celebrate stuff.
Yeah.
And so it then sent me into this kind of like rabbit hole of, well, first of all, when I was thinking about that and I got that email from my friend, I like sent her a ranty voice note back, and then sort of sat on the sofa. I was like, oh, this is the book. And so that was the origin story of the book. And then it just sent me down this rabbit hole of thinking about the things I've done over the, you know, decades with different friends, like the different kind of fun ways we've hung out. And then also thinking about the other ways I know other friends have done that with their friends, or friends of friends have done these things. So I kind of started gathering then all these stories about the ways that people have spent meaningful time together. And sometimes those things are once a year because it's a certain thing or it's a ritual they have and whatever. And sometimes it is every week, every month, yeah, whatever it is. And it was just like a really fun, wholesome thing. And then that's how the book is kind of shaping up, is with those examples. But then I'm sort of adding in some other things, and there's some nuggets of research and stuff in there as well. But the idea is that it's not a dense prose book of like, this is why friends are good, because like everyone knows that. It's more around, and this is how to get over the initiation gap of suggesting to doing something else, because everyone sort of wants more. Like the conversations I have with everyone is, oh yeah, I wish I had more time for my friends, I wish I did more with them, but everyone's kind of waiting for someone else to initiate something.
Yeah,
it's like, be that person. And so if this book, someone can, because it's going to be really beautifully designed, so if someone can snap a photo of one of the ideas, send it to a friend and be like, should we try this? Like, that is a big win for me.
I love that. I love the idea of celebrating just random things and being the initiator. And I think it's interesting, like, even reflecting on the different friendship circles. You just said you deliberately had people around your kitchen table who didn't know each other. Mm. Most people would freak out about the thought of doing that.
Yeah, and I knew that there was a couple of people in... Actually, less so at that one, actually, because I curated those people so that, because I knew they would get on well. When I did my 10-year Ozziversary dinner last July on my 10-year Ozziversary, I invited 12 of the people who had been a big part of my decade. And some of those I'd met a month after arriving here. They'd actually arrived on the same flight
as me
and had moved from the UK as well. Oh, wow. So we have the same Ozziversary. Super fun. We got our citizenship within like weeks of each other. We had our tests on the same day.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's wild. Anyway, so they're really special. And so they were there. They've been there since like pretty much the beginning, well, literally the beginning. And then friends I'd met, a few months before, but we'd become really close. So I had this kind of chronological kind of group of 12 people. And of course, there are many more than 12 people who have made my decade. But with those ones, there was more of a mix of like the kind of some quieter friends, some people who are a bit less, more or less introverted, extroverted, etc. So with that group, it was much more around making them feel more comfortable with each other. So choosing the seating setup and stuff as well, because it was kind of around a long table. So being like, okay, well, these people will be here and there'll be someone who can kind of bring some of the people out, but without being so kind of intense. And then the really loud ones up the back.
Yeah.
The trouble corner, as we kind of ended up calling it. But kind of, so there is kind of curation involved and thinking about how to kind of make that work as well. Yeah.
So I feel like, listening to you, it's almost like you're facilitating your friendship parties.
Yeah. And I think there is, and Priya Parker's book, The Art of Gathering, has been such a pivotal part of my last kind of, well, since it came out in 2017, 2018, I think that book came out. I read it pretty early after it came out. And it was so validating reading that and being like, oh, this is actually an art, but also this is part of facilitation. And her positioning that actually you can't just be the kind of the chill host. There has to be some intent and boundaries and kind of to an extent rules and stuff around these things. And the fact that the more effort you put in, the more people are probably going to get out of it as well. And it's not a workshop, and I definitely don't do it that way. Although I'm sure there's been a flip chart or something at one of my things, I'm sure, or if there'll be one in the near future. But I think that's really important as well. And when I talk to some of my younger friends who are kind of Gen Z, Gen Z folk, I spoke to someone the other day who just, the word he used was yearning. Like, his friends are really yearning for that kind of like connection and the intent and the kind of the meaningful, the other word he kept using was like activation, like the activations of friendships.
Oh.
Not just like, he was like, I don't want to go to your birthday party. I want to come to your, like the weird thing you're doing.
Yeah.
you've got like a whole theme around and it's got this whole, meaning for or whatever. So I just think there's like so much more space for that. But it takes energy. And I think the other thing as well, like there is such a, I referred to it as the other day when I was talking to someone about connection as a commodity. Like everything's a bit transient and a bit easy. Like there's not that much friction anymore with, sending a message or not sending a message or replying or not replying or just swiping right or left or whatever it is on different apps. So therefore, there seems to be more of a culture of kind of flakiness and people being like, oh, I don't have to kind of commit to that thing. I don't have to go to that thing. And I think if you show that actually you should come to this thing, because there's going to be these interesting people there and actually we care that you're coming.
Yeah.
Like by doing that thing up front of sending that message and being like, hey, here's all the cool people you're going to be sat with. Who are you going to be lucky enough to sit next to? You'll see when you turn up kind of thing. Like, and then a little blurb about each person. Like that's really cool. And it means people are like, oh, yeah, that is going to be something that's worth the limited time I have or the energy I have to go to that thing.
But Steph, how do you have the energy to do that?
I don't have children.
Neither do I.
This is very important. No, I mean, that's not life advice, but, you know, if you want to take it that way, please do. But no, I mean, that is also the joke that my friends with kids have on me. So I'm like, well, of course you can do these things. You don't have children. Which, you know, there's probably some truth in that as well. It's a joke, but there's definitely some truth in it. But I think it's a priority for me,
yeah,
ultimately. And it's something that I want to put my time into. And I think when I think about my decision to not have children, which has always been the decision, like this was never a thing I had to grapple with or anything. Like I've just been like, oh no, you, yuck, like, my whole life. And so, and one of the benefits of that, that I'm really excited about, is being able to then have this extra energy for these types of things.
Yeah.
Like I can be the friend that maybe there isn't the same level of reciprocity, like coming back all the time. And not that I think my friends are like users of me or anything like that, but I know that not all of them will do those things, but I know what an impact it has on them when I do.
Yeah.
And that's great. Like, that's amazing. Like, I love that for that friendship. And I get, you know, it's still a give and take relationship. It's not just that I'm pumping all this energy in and getting nothing back. That's definitely not the case because I don't have those people in my life. But I think, yeah, it gives me energy as well.
Would you say as well, Steph, in terms of, because we've talked a bit about structuring these gatherings and there's a curatorship to it, there's an art to it. Ultimately, though, would you say that, you know, the facilitation is ultimately because everyone really does want to have that meaningful connection, even if, you know, from the outset or from a superficial lens, it might seem like this person wouldn't come and have this conversation, this person wouldn't come and connect with the new person, but probably everyone would if they were given the opportunity in the right circumstances. Is that something that you find when you have these events?
I think so, yeah. And I think the fact that these people aren't strangers to me, so yeah. I know where the line is for some of those friends and things. So I know that, okay, that person's going to need that person to come as well for them to have a good time.
Mm.
And that they'll both have a good time then, and then other people have a good, like that. So I think if it's strangers, there's probably a bit more of that you have to kind of create, or it's just a bit more difficult because you don't know the people. But I think there's a big part of that, you're knowing people and being like, I know what it's going to take for all of these people and all their different weird needs to have a nice time. And the fact that you can, yeah, I think people want to know that it matters.
Yeah.
I think that's fine.
Yeah.
That it matters and they matter.
And yeah.
It's so interesting. I do just have a question around the difference between females and males. Mm. I know it's highly stereotypical, but it's one thing that I talk about with my husband a lot because, you know, he goes and has dinner with his friends or friend, you know, like they have one-on-one catch-ups and they don't talk about themselves. They talk about things. They'll talk about the football. They'll talk about politics. They'll talk about, you know, all of these things. And I'll be like, well, how's their wife? And what's their, did they get that promotion at work? Or did that, you know, and he'll be like, I don't know. And so then I'm often like amazed at the different dynamics between male and female friendships. Is that something you are exploring or conscious of or like you think about when you're doing some of the things that you've just been talking about?
Yeah, there's a couple of things, like in my own personal friendships, but I'll come back to that. But in the book writing, what's been really interesting is so many people are like, what about the men? are you hearing from the men? Like, yes, the men are talking. there is that kind of piece of, and what I've noticed, and again, purely anecdotal, and I have actually tried to get in touch with a couple of researchers who work, yeah, actually researchers in this field, to see if this, what I'm noticing kind of more anecdotally, is something that has any backing. Is that a lot of the men I talk to or have submitted stories and stuff for the book, a lot of them seem to have friendships from much further back.
Yes.
Like they're friends with their school friends still.
Yeah.
Or their friends they played football with or cricket or whatever their sport kind of was. They're friends from when they were 11. And they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s now, whatever. Whereas women seem to have like just a broader group of friends from like different parts of their life. And, you know, my kind of a very loose hypothesis is that because the life changes that many women, even if they choose to and can have children, is just much more disruptive to their lives. They end up having to have all these different kind of groups of friends to support in different ways. And that as women, we are maybe more inclined to look for support in those ways as well. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. There's a piece I was reading not so long ago, and I can't quote the study or the kind of piece around it, so don't quote me on it. Around how a lot of, it's, you know, the sort of term uses like man keeping. So a lot of a man, you know, in a heterosexual relationship, a lot of the man's emotional needs are met by their female partners.
Yeah.
So therefore they don't look for that from their male friends or their, you know, or other, you know, other friends of other genders. They, because they just get that from their female partner. So therefore, but then that puts a lot more emphasis or onus on the female partner. So then they have to kind of spread that then through their kind of friendship groups as well. But then, you know, everyone's kind of doing that with each other. So there's that. And I think there was some kind of research I was reading just the other day, actually, about how men would generally prefer to hang out with another friend when they're actually doing something. Mm-hmm. Like it's the kind of next to versus face to face.
Yeah.
Their preferred hangout, generally is more like we're doing something, we're not actually having an actual conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're next to each other, we're doing a thing.
We're watching a movie together.
Watching a movie, watching sport.
Playing a game.
Building something.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. Whereas women are more like to sit down, look each other in the eye and be like, how are you?
Yeah.
Tell me.
Does this resonate with you, Luke?
Yeah, somewhat. I do think that definitely having things like adjacent, like, yeah, having playing video games or watching something, it provides a little bit of a buffer maybe to have, because I still think I have those quite deep conversations, the how I use, but there might not be, as you said, face to face. There might be with something in the middle to make that kind of a little bit easier.
I think if it works and you're actually, as long as you're having that, you feel like you've got that support, like, I mean, play your video game, like, yeah. Do your thing.
My hubby's best friend is over here for a month staying with us from Geraldton, and they text each other almost every day, like they're talking. But I can't get over when they're together, because him and his wife are living with us, how my husband's now a different person for a month. Like, it's really interesting to watch. And
do you prefer him or like?
Sometimes
or worse?
I look at him and I just think, who are you? Like, I do think that with some of the stuff he says. And then I've been married for a long time. I just think, wow, like, without having your friend here regularly, are we suppressing something as well? You know, I just wonder. That's how important friendships are, and to be face-to-face and things like that. But I sometimes think he just seems, I don't know, happier or more alive, if that makes sense, you know, that when his friend is there. But it's interesting when you say about they don't talk about emotional stuff and all that, because his wife is very good friends with me, and we're talking, you know, the first thing I'm saying to her is, you know, how's it going? How are you emotionally coping with things? Whereas these two are just talking about concepts and talking, having big fights about Apple, what's better, and, you know, like, it's such a different conversation. Mm. So, yeah, it's really interesting to see.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, like, even with your comment around this different, he's a different person, actually, how much of that is you're seeing a fuller person,
yeah,
but you only get the source, the husband slice.
But yes.
Actually, yeah, we're multi, you know, multi-disciplined and multi-faceted.
100%. So I'm just wondering, Steph, with your book, do you want more people to be writing into you, submitting stories? Is there any way we can link that in with our podcast episode?
Yeah, I can. We'll put a link in the show notes.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
But yeah, there is a way to send me those things. At the moment, because I'm sort of most of the way through the writing, I am still taking, you know, will always take submissions until I, you know, hand over the manuscript. But the sort of forms and things are closed down, but you can definitely still get in touch with those stories. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
Yeah. Because even if it doesn't go in the book, there's other things I'm doing. So I have a newsletter, which I've just started this month, which is called How to Friend. So the book is called How to Friend.
And I like that.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? And so the book is called How to Friend, and there's a newsletter that goes along with it as well, which started this month. And this month, I start with the big juicy topic of what happens when your friends all have children.
Yeah, I read that.
Resonate?
I feel like we need you back to have a big discussion about that. Totally resonates.
Yeah. I was particularly pleased with the pun that I had on the title of that one. It's called Mind the Nap, Friendship Across the Parenting Divide.
I think that's such an important conversation to have. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.